Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the critical hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Trump continues to try to antagonize Iran. On Tuesday, May 7th, President Trump announced that he was withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. Even though the United States' closest allies and most sensible advisors in the U.S. advised him against it. Quote, "It is clear to me that we cannot prevent an Iranian nuclear bomb under the decaying and rotten structure of the current government," Trump said from the White House diplomatic room, and he continued, "The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen," end quote. Well, he's back at it again. Late Sunday evening, Trump issued a stern warning to Iranian President Hassan Rouhani in all caps, tweeting that the Iranian leader will suffer consequences if he threatens the United States. "To Iranian President Rouhani, never ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. We are no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death. Be cautious." Why? Why do this? Trump's message is reported to be in response to comments President Rouhani made earlier in the day, in which he cautioned Trump about the devastation of a U.S.-Iran wartime conflict and threatened the president, telling him not to interfere in Tehran's government. Quote, "Mr. Trump, don't play with the lion's tail. This would only lead to regret," Rouhani told a gathering of Iranian diplomats. "America should know that peace with Iran is the mother of all peace, and war with Iran is the mother of all wars," Rouhani said, continuing, "You are not in a position to incite the Iranian nation against Iran's security and interests," end quote. I believe President Rouhani's statement, "America should know that peace with Iran is the mother of all peace," is his way of saying, dude, get a grip and calm down. You also have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo following a similar tack by calling Iran's religious leaders hypocritical holy men, whom he says are more interested in lining their pockets and spreading hardline views abroad than helping out their own cash-strapped citizens. I think Pompeo got confused. I think he was writing to Rouhani, but talking about Trump. People more interested in lining their pockets? Sounds like a lot of Trump's cabinet members, whether it's Homeland Security, whether it's EPA, whether it is pick one. Anyway, Americans need to ask themselves, where's the true upside to this bellicose jingoistic rhetoric? If this is Trump and his art of the deal trying to get Iran to the table, remember, they were at the table. Deals were done and getting done. And Trump came in the room and turned the tables over. I don't see any upside here. As violence flares, Kushner threatens to abandon a plan B for the Mideast rebuilding Gaza. So listen to how the New York Times tells this story. Quote, 5 months ago, Jared Kushner began quietly shifting his focus from brokering a peace accord between Israel and the Palestinians to tackling the dire humanitarian crisis in the Palestinian enclave of Gaza. Now, with Israel and the Hamas militants who control Gaza in a fresh cycle of violence that analysts fear could escalate into a full-blown war, Mr. Kushner and his partner in Middle East peacemaking, Jason Greenblatt, are threatening to pull the plug on Plan B, declaring that no foreign investors are willing to pour money into Gaza during what they label a Hamas-driven conflict. Mr. Kushner and Mr. Greenblatt, the president's special representative for international negotiations, are rethinking their efforts to rebuild Gaza's economy as a way of opening the door to a broader peace accord. Quote, Hamas has driven Gaza to a state of desperation, Mr. Kushner said on Sunday. Provocations will not be rewarded with aid, end quote. Now that's the New York Times. There's no mention in this story of Israel attacking and murdering unarmed protesters. There's no mention of the UN General Assembly condemning Israel on June 13th for excessive use of force against Palestinian civilians and asked UN Chief Antonio Guterres to recommend an international protection mechanism for occupied Palestinian territory. There's no mention of how wrong the U.S. was to move its embassy to Jerusalem and back Israel's play, naming it as the capital. No mention of the ethnic cleansing and the apartheid nature of the new basic law calling Israel a Jewish state. Folks, you really have to be discerning about what you read and how it's read. Again, Jared Kushner, of all people, is saying no foreign investors are willing to pour money into Gaza during what they have labeled a Hamas-driven conflict, and they are rethinking their efforts to rebuild Gaza's economy as a way of opening the door to a broader peace accord? Kushner and Greenblatt being put in charge of this Herculean task is analogous to President Obama putting President Clinton and Bush in charge of rebuilding Haiti after the earthquake. Your message is understood by the messenger or messengers you send to deliver it. All rational thinking people could see from the outset that the U.S. is not an independent arbiter of this problem, and the New York Times is once again being used to spread the propaganda. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is much more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. So, Trump's back at it again. Late Sunday evening, he issued a stern warning to Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, in all caps tweeting that the leader will suffer consequences if he threatens the U.S. To Iranian President Rouhani, never even threaten the United States again. Never ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. We are no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death. Be cautious. Why? Why do this? Well, to get some insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He is a scholar, activist, a true thinker and intellectual, former dean of the Black Studies Department at Ohio University, former head of the King Center in Atlanta, Tom Porter. Tom, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Good evening, Wilmer.
Before we get to the Iran issue, I know you were holding when I made the point about Kushner and Greenblatt in Israel, Trump's emissaries or point people on this so-called peace initiative. And I made the point that Kushner and Greenblatt being put in charge of this Herculean task is analogous to President Obama putting Clinton and Bush in charge of rebuilding Haiti after the earthquake. Haitians, as I recall, were incredibly incensed and insulted by the fact that Clinton and Bush were put in charge of that effort. And I said that your message is understood by the messengers you send to deliver it. Is that, in your opinion, an accurate assessment?
I think it's very accurate. You know, there probably was never any intention to rebuild Gaza to begin with. And so, you throw something up against the wall, then at some point you say, well, we wanted to do it, but we can't do it because Hamas has created a situation so that no investors really want to invest in Gaza. Well, the fact of it is that the Palestinians and Gaza, the whole situation in the Middle East and the Palestinian territory has been created by Israel and maintained by Israel. So that, in my mind, I don't think that Jared Kushner and his cohort ever had any intention, or the Trump administration never had any intentions of rebuilding Gaza any more than they have any intention of rebuilding Libya or Iraq or Syria.
Well said, sir. Well said. And coming from a man who has traveled to the region and understands the politics quite well. So help me out here. Why now is Trump trying to stick his finger in the eye of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani?
Well, that's what Trump does. You know, he uses bellicose language whenever he finds himself in a tight spot. He's in a very tight spot over the recent meeting with Vladimir Putin. And so whenever he's in a tight spot, he throws something up against the wall. And his bellicose language plays well with his base. I mean, they're not thinking deeply or seriously about the implications of a threatened war with Iran. All they want to do is to hear Trump say, be tough. On the other hand, a recent poll showed that the Americans expect, many of them predict that there would be a civil war in America. So Trump, this is what he does, the mother of all bombs, the mother of all wars. And it plays well to his base. But the fact of it is he was weakened by his performance in Helsinki. The case against him and Russian interfering with the election, that's still going on. His administration really is in a shambles. And so what he does is he used tweets to just sound tough. Today it's Iran. Tomorrow it may be somebody else. He may go back to North Korea and threaten them. The fact of it is, he talks about Obama being weak. He hasn't delivered on any of his bellicose promises of mothers of all wars, mothers of all bombs, mothers of this, mothers of that. So it's just another attempt to divert attention away from the real problems that he's facing.
You know, in looking at President Rouhani's response, he opens by saying, America should know that peace with Iran is the mother of all peace. That, to me, was Rouhani saying to Trump, man, calm down. There's a whole lot of good that could come from this. But Trump seems to want to just smoke at the gas station while he's fueling his car. I think Rouhani is right. Peace with Iran could be the mother of all peace, or it could go a very long way in establishing, bringing about stability in the region. But it really doesn't seem as though that's what America wants.
Well, the fact of it is, Dr. Leon, is that all of this is being driven by Israel's desire. In fact, they're negotiating with the Russians now to move Iranian forces from the southern part of Syria, when in fact Israel is saying that's not enough. We want Iran out of Syria, which the Iranians rightly responded by saying that we'll leave if we're asked by Assad. Other than that, we're staying. You know, so it's being driven by Israel. Israel has always saw Iran as the problem in the Middle East as far as its hegemonic desires in the Middle East. The Saudis, none of them actually have a military that's capable of defeating the Iranians. And the United States wants to pull out of Syria, which will leave Israel exposed at a certain level. And so Israel is driving this entire thing. So you have to, as Dr. King would say, facts in and of themselves is unimportant. It's interrelatedness of facts. So you have to look at Krishna pulling out of Gaza, which they never intended to do. You have to look at the bilateral meetings that have been going on between Putin and Bibi. And then you have to look at the fact that American foreign policy has been driven by Israel for a very, very long time, especially when it comes to the Middle East.
There are two things I'd like to elaborate more on, two points that you made. One, you talked about hegemony, and I think it's very, very important for people in the West to understand that it's not so much that Iran is funding terrorists, it's that Iran is a problem for the United States and Israel as they want to exert their influence and their hegemony over the region. Iran is not allowing the United States and Israel to just run roughshod over anybody that they want to in the region. And when you talk about Dr. King saying facts aren't relevant, it's the interrelatedness of them. When we look at the Helsinki, I'll just call it discussion, what, again, a lot of people don't understand is that Netanyahu went to Moscow and met with President Putin the week before Putin went to Helsinki. So really what they were talking about, now I wasn't in the room and the interpreter hasn't called me, but from what I've understood that they really talked about was how does Russia convince Iran to withdraw from around the Golan Heights? Assad stays in Syria, but withdraws from around the Golan Heights. And Putin saying, okay, well, we can work this out, but you're going to have to pay a price for this. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, I mean, the understanding is that Syria can place its forces along the Golan Heights, but the bottom line of it is that they want Iran out. It is not in Iran's strategic interest to withdraw from Syria because if Syria could defend itself, Iran nor the Russians would have been there to begin with. So they want Iran out of the Middle East. They want to isolate Iran. That's why Trump withdrew from the nuclear agreement with Iran. And so if Assad is left in charge of Syria, they're no longer talking about regime change. There's nothing to change. Syria has been destroyed. It'll take 20, 30 years to rebuild Syria. Take 20, 30 years to rebuild Iraq. Take the same amount of time to rebuild Libya. So the point about Assad now staying, what is he really in charge of, and what could he really do against any of his enemies, particularly Israel, if the Iranians and Russians withdrew?
I heard a press conference, I think it was today, Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, is talking about the United States' interests are really with the Iranian people and freeing the Iranian people from their despotic and their, I can't remember the other word he used, but despotic is good enough, dictatorship. And he seemed to forget that Iran has a democracy, that they just had elections a few months ago. Somewhere in the close of 80% of the people went to the polls, and that the Iranians, for the most part, have the government that they voted for. And that really, if you remove Rouhani, as far as Iranian politics goes, in the relations to the West, is a fairly moderate guy. So if you remove Rouhani, you create a vacuum the likes of which we, to Rouhani's point, the mother of all wars, that's a real mess. I don't even think Trump comprehends this, nor Pompeo, nor Bolton, I don't think they understand the depths to which the problems that they would cause if they got rid of the moderates that are in control of Iran right now.
Well, I don't. I mean, I think Pompeo basically said that the Iranian people should rise up and overthrow the Iranian government. Well, if I say that in terms of the United States, that black people should rise up with their allies and move to overthrow the United States government, the Trump administration, they would be outside my door right now.
No, they'd be inside your house.
Right. That's the narrative. That's the narrative. First, you say that there are three parts of the narrative. One is they're killing their own people. The people want to be free, but they are oppressing their own people. Two is the leadership is corrupt. And corrupt, and they have a lot of money. I mean, everybody's got a lot of money. Vladimir Putin, his family's rich. That's part of the narrative. And of course, when you lay that out, you know, one, that they're killing their own people. Two is that the leadership is corrupt. And third is the only people who could really solve this problem is the United States. And of course, the world is seeing what they do, how they use the NGOs to pass out cell phones to try and organize the people to overthrow the government. And it probably won't happen, but they don't really care if it actually happens. What they care about is that their base, the people who will forgive Trump for anything that he does, that they keep building on that base. And then you couple with the fact that Bannon has said that he's forming a foundation to organize the right wing in Europe. All of this is part of the whole Make America Great Again, which reads that America is not great. It never was. You can't be a great country built on slavery and genocide, so it never was. But what you do is to try and build up. They're trying to build up an international economic nationalism thrust in the world. Some people would say fascism. But the fact of it is, that's what they are trying to do. And all of this bellicose language is meant to strengthen their base, strengthen right-wing forces in Europe. So that's the strategy. I don't think it will work. I don't think the Americans are going to accept fascism in America. I certainly hope not.
So this is really for domestic consumption, and it's also the predicate for the $87 billion increase this year in the defense budget, which is $17 billion more than the entire allocation for the Department of Education. So it's really, again, for domestic consumption, and it's to see to it that Lockheed Martin and Raytheon Corporation and McDonnell Douglas, that they get their share of the pie.
And to cover up for the fact that bit by bit, the Trump administration and its attack on what it calls the deep state is undermining the very social safety net that Americans need at a point, particularly at this point now, because trade war is not working. They're not going to outmaneuver the Chinese. It's going to cause more unemployment. It's going to cause businesses to shut down in this country. But so, because there's no money, it went to the deficit is increasing. So you just can't keep printing money as they do. The deficit is increasing. So you got to keep, it's for domestic consumption. Everything that Trump does is to try and organize his base. Hopefully they'll be so energized that they'll be able to survive the midterm elections. But he's not going to invade Iran. Israel might. But the United States isn't. The American people will not. The American people don't want to see more bodies coming home. That's why Trump wants to get out of Syria, because you can win a war. You can
win the battle and lose the war.
Right. You can start a, you can bomb like mad, but eventually you got to put boots on the ground. Americans don't want to do that.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I remember, and you were at this press conference when Minister Farrakhan was talking about the first Iraq war. And Minister Farrakhan said, and I know you were there because I remember I listened to your voice on the playback all the time asking the minister, but the minister said, you can't win with your technology. He said, after a week, you're going to have to bring your soldiers in here. And when you do, they got something for you. And he was absolutely right.
The America has not won a war, been victorious in a war since World War II. They lost in Vietnam. They lost in Korea. They're losing. They lost in Syria. They were not able to get rid of Assad. So now they say, after having destroyed the country.
They lost in Afghanistan. I wrote a piece years ago, Afghanistan, Where Empires Go to Die. And the point of the piece was, all you're doing, if Alexander the Great couldn't conquer it, what makes you think you can? All you're doing is replacing war elephants with F-16s. But the premise still remains the same. Those folks are there to win, and they don't play.
The fact of it is, America's not going to be great again under Trump. There is some doubt as to whether or not it will regain its footing as a major power. It will remain a major military power, but as an economic power, the Chinese are outmaneuvering them with the Belt and Road Initiative. All over the world, every time America leaves, the Chinese move in. The Chinese have something to offer. America's involved in Africa. What does it do? It's simply arms dictators. Eventually, the people are going to rise up, because in the final analysis, people want peace.
Right.
People want peace.
People want security, and people want stability.
Even Trump's base wants peace. They just think the way to go about it
is through war.
It's a war, and it's simply not going to work, because the world is tired of war.
You made the point that, again, talking about the trade war, you're hearing rumblings, but it's not really being covered. You've got farmers from Iowa, soybean farmers from South Dakota, that are coming to Washington saying, you're killing us. We've planted 51 however many billions of dollars worth of soybeans, we won't be able to sell them. You've got Trump calling for no Mercedes-Benz to be made, to be driven on the streets of New York, when the biggest Mercedes factory and the biggest BMW factories are in Alabama and in Tennessee. You've got the Japanese that are driving up the price of the bourbon market, and they're putting tariffs on bourbon. So the Chinese, they're being incredibly, incredibly strategic in their responses to Trump and where they are applying their tariffs.
The fact of it is, the Chinese point out that many of the companies that will be hurt are American companies located in China who export their goods to America. So, but it sounds good. It sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna put tariffs. You know, we're gonna put tariffs on the European Union. We're gonna put tariffs on Canada and what have you. And what this is doing is driving people closer together. The European Union is now trying to figure out a way how to get around the tariffs and what have you. So he's losing, but it looks like he's winning. Today it's Iran. He threatened, in so many words, to bomb Iran. Pompeo called for insurrection in Iran. I mean, these guys really are eating a long way away from the table.
I like that. I like that. I'll use that. And I've been to Iran twice. I was in Tehran, and I've been all over the country and talking to a lot of just average, everyday Iranians. And for as frustrated as they are about their current standard of living, the one thing to a person that I walked away from conversations understanding, you try to mess with their country and you talk about a sense of nationalism, and it's a religious nationalism. I had a 2-hour conversation with former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Those folks don't play.
Well, I mean, they've actually they've seen what happened in Nicaragua. I mean, they see what's happening. Nicaragua is a bad example. I'm not clear about what's actually going on there. Mm-hmm. Certainly in Venezuela, the sanctions and blockade of Cuba. Sanctions are designed to encourage the people to turn against the leader.
And they never work.
It never works because you can't give people cell phones and smuggle in weapons and what have you, but in the final analysis, it doesn't really translate into a higher standard of living.
Let me ask you this, Tom, because you have a much broader understanding of history than I do. Can you think of one instance where sanctions actually achieved the desired result, and that is turning the people against the government?
No, it hasn't happened.
That's okay.
No, it hasn't happened.
Okay.
And it probably won't happen.
Okay. Because what it does is it increases the sense of nationalism, and it gives the leader of the country the narrative to say, you see, it's us versus them. It's not me that's messing you up. It's the sanctions that the outside is putting on us. We must rally around the flag and defeat the enemy.
It certainly does not encourage leaders to be less vigilant of countries that you're threatening to put sanctions on. And what it does, you're right, it organizes the people. And even if there are forces within a country, the leaders, no leader is going to simply allow his country to be destroyed. They already saw the destruction of the Soviet Union, and they saw what happened to in Libya. So they've seen all of these things, and even Putin, who's talking with Netanyahu, and I understand that,
mm-hmm.
I understand what that's all about. But the fact of it is, Putin knows that the Americans are never going to be friends or trust the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. No, because the American narrative has to have a boogeyman, and Russia is that boogeyman.
Russia also perhaps has a stronger nuclear arsenal than the United States. And so Trump is not going to talk about, he's not going to threaten Russia.
Especially when you look now, from what I understand, the move now is submarine-based. And so when you look at submarine-based nuclear capacity, let's just say it's too close to call.
And even the Japanese, when there was a time when Japan was making really some really strong moves economically, the United States didn't stop until it undermined that. So even the Japanese. So when you talk about the Korean Peninsula, the Koreans, North and South, the Japanese and the Chinese, understands that the Americans are not their friends.
Let me stop you there. Tom Porter, as always, thank you for your time and for your analysis, and look forward to getting you back on the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Hey, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is set to host the first ever Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom. Foreign ministers and other elected and public figures from more than 80 countries are expected to attend the 3-day event in Washington, D.C., which starts tomorrow. The ministerial is intended to discuss outcomes, to reaffirm international commitments to protect and preserve the religious freedom rights of all people. Those in attendance will also talk about ways to fight religious persecution and discrimination and ensure greater respect for religious freedom for all. What does this mean? Let's talk with my next guest to get some ideas. He is the president, Progressive National Baptist Convention, Dr. James C. Perkins. Dr. Perkins, welcome to the Critical Hour.
And it's a delight to be with you, Dr. Leon. Thank you for inviting me to be a part of your wonderful show.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Before we get to the subject matter at hand, Progressive National Baptist Convention, I know the word progressive is there for a reason. I know it was not put there, or the thought behind putting it there was not taken lightly. Explain the Progressive National Baptist Convention.
The Progressive National Baptist Convention was founded in 1962, and it was created to give a denominational and spiritual home to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and many of the Baptist pastors at that time who supported him in the civil rights movement. Our focus is on the justice theme of the Bible. And so our uniqueness and our distinctive is that as a Baptist group, we wed spirituality with social justice.
So is that following then in with Reverend Cone? As and others along the...
In terms of black theology?
Yes. Yes, sir. Liberation theology. Liberation theology.
Yes. Liberation theology.
Howard Thurman. I was trying to get to Howard Thurman and Reverend Cone.
Thurman. Yes, Howard Thurman. Dr. James Cone, the late Dr. James Cone. Our theology is based on much of what they talked about. Yes.
Got you. Thank you. Thank you very much for that clarity.
So the justice theme of the Bible.
Thank you, sir. So now help me out. The United States State Department, they're gearing up to host what is being described as the first ever three-day ministerial to promote and advance religious freedom in Washington, D.C., which will be attended by delegates and leaders from over 80 countries. Is this the job of the Department of State? I mean, before we even get to the particulars of the mission itself, is the mission being given to the right team?
Well, I would tend to say no, because the First Amendment itself is clear about the fact that Congress should not intervene in a person's religion. And so I'm a little skeptical about what this meeting is all about. Will it favor one religious group over another? I know that recently with this president and his administration that they have expressed a discriminatory idea about Muslims. I'm curious to see what the outcome will be.
And it's also interesting that I believe former Senator Brownback is Sam Brownback is the one who's really in charge of this ministerial as a former diplomat, and he has an incredibly troubling background as a former governor of...
I think it was Kansas.
Kansas. Thank you, sir. Yes. He signed laws that barred state courts from taking into account Islamic or Sharia law when making decisions. He's joined Republican governors in trying to bar Syrian refugees from being settled in Kansas. I mean, those are just some examples. He has a very long history of bigoted perspectives that are, one would say, less than forgiving, less than open, less than Christian.
And I would agree. And I'm concerned also about what they're referring to as the white right-wing evangelicals. Are they going to be making decisions that would help them to focus on issues like a woman's right to an abortion and other issues that the right wing so-called evangelicals support? Is this just a meeting to convene and to determine what the government will support in religion? I believe that there should be a clear distinction, a separation of church and state. I had an old church history professor years ago who said whenever the church and the state go to bed together, the church always ends up getting screwed. And so, you know, there ought to be a clear, discernible distinction between the state and the practice of religion. So I'm curious to see what these outcomes will be. One of the things that you mentioned in the opening statement was that this ministerial will focus also on religious discrimination. And so what you pointed out about former Senator Brownback are discriminatory practices that he has had legislation to approve. So, you know, again, it'll be interesting to see what the outcome will be.
In fact, when Brownback was being questioned as a potential ambassador, he didn't answer questions about his perspective on LGBT issues. They said he wasn't unequivocal enough that religious rights don't trump the right to be free from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And so we know now with this whole religious freedom idea in this country with the Masterpiece Cake Shop, for example, give me your insight on where you are as the president of the Progressive National Baptist Convention, for example, on the Masterpiece Cake Shop case and this whole idea of religious freedom and people being able to discriminate in this country based upon their religious preference.
My understanding of that particular case was that the Supreme Court stopped just short of saying that a particular religious belief could cause a person to not serve LGBT community. They overturned a particular law that had been passed in Colorado. And in Colorado, the baker was basing his refusal of creating or baking a cake for a gay couple on his religion. And the Supreme Court stopped just short of it by saying that, you know, the Colorado Commission was right and that they did not go as far as saying that a person's religious belief could prevent him or her from serving same-sex couples. It's interesting, however, because there will be more cases that will come before the Supreme Court that will challenge that point of view. And this is part of what I'm trying to say with this ministerial gathering. Is this a gathering to support these kinds of beliefs? What's the next step? Will a person's religious belief stop them from serving black people? Will it stop them from being able to open public accommodations to minorities? So it's a concern. And again, I say I'll be interested to see what the outcomes are.
You know, I have looked at this quite extensively, whether it's the Hobby Lobby case or whether it's the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, Dr. Perkins. And I think the analysis of this is very, very simple. If, as a business, you have to get a license from the state in order to operate, then you must follow state law and you must not be allowed to discriminate on religious reasons or any other reason. You have to serve everybody equal opportunity, equal access as guaranteed in the 14th Amendment. You should not be allowed now to say, my religion is such that I refuse to serve so-and-so. No, you have a license from the state to do business. You must serve all comers or lose your license.
Well, I totally agree with you. Again, it will be interesting to see whether or not this ministerial is being gathered in order to give the state power to dictate to churches. There ought to be a clear distinction between church and state. Church and religion, a person's religion, is autonomous. Churches are autonomous. And as long as they're not hurting people, killing people, and so forth, they should have the freedom to practice what they believe without discrimination.
And also, the question becomes on the international side and how there are many Christian conservatives that have been trying to restrict U.S. foreign aid to countries as it relates to family planning and as it relates to other things that right-wing Christians are opposed to within their own theological backgrounds or theological premises. That has been used as leverage to deny aid to countries.
I agree. And so is this gathering a gathering to decide and to codify those right-wing evangelicals' point of view so that even they deny Muslims entrance into the United States and so forth just based on the fact that they are of a different religious persuasion? Again, it'll be interesting to see what the outcome will be. What is the purpose of this? Is this just another Trump administration distraction to get us looking over this way so we will forget last week the debacle in Russia when he met with President Putin? Is it a distraction to take our minds off of the fact that he was had lied about providing monies, hush money for a paramour that he had? Is this just one of the other distractions that he's creating so that we will forget about all the other things that he's done as a sign of his failure as a president?
I should have asked you this question at the very beginning of this conversation. I need you to continue to educate me. What is a ministerial?
A gathering of ministers. A gathering of ministers who represent a particular religious point of view and persuasion.
And that's why I wanted you to give that definition, because it's not only a gathering of ministers, but it's a gathering of ministers with a particular, give that again,
religious persuasion, a particular religious point of view.
So one could assume with Brownback and Pompeo that this is Christian, a Christian ministerial.
Well, I'm not sure that it's solely a Christian ministerial. My understanding is that it represents several religions, and they're not just ministers, but they're also representatives of their particular governments. So it's a ministerial of ministers and government officials.
Were you invited to attend?
I was not invited to attend, and I do not know anyone who was invited to attend.
My engineer is telling me she can't find, she's gone through a list of trying to find who has been invited and cannot find any African-American organizations or ministers that were invited.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. Here again, you see, from the outset, they're practicing religious discrimination by not inviting a broad sector of religious groups to be a part of the conversation.
Is there an attempt by yourself and or other similarly minded ministers to write a response to this, to come out and speak out against this, to wait and see what comes from this? Is there any type of planned response based upon the outcome?
Yes, there will be a planned response based upon the outcome. But in the meantime, the Progressive National Baptist Convention will convene our 57th annual session in the city of Philadelphia the week of August the 6th through the 10th. And one of our foci will be to call out this right-wing evangelical religious community for the support that they're giving to President Trump and his administration. Here they have taken children right out of the arms of their mothers and parents. They have supported him in denying food stamps to elderly people, families who need it, and children taking food right out of their mouths. Even the tax bill that so many of them are talking about how wonderful it is built on the back of taking money from the poor. So we will be focusing on those issues because the Bible clearly dictates and says that you should look out, a government should practice compassion by looking out for the poor, the needy, and the orphan.
Well, but Dr. Perkins, the administration has come out and told us that the war on poverty is over. The administration has told us that the war on poverty is won.
Well, I tend to disagree. I live in the city of Detroit, and I still have a number of unemployed people who come to my church looking for jobs. I know that this president and this administration wants to boast about having the lowest unemployment level in years and how they have the highest employment rate for Black and African Americans and Hispanics. But I tend to disagree. The reality is that I see still a whole lot of unemployment and poor people who are in need that this administration is taking from them in order to give to the rich. It's Robin Hood.
What are the dates of your national convention again, sir?
August the 6th through the 10th.
And is it possible, hopefully, we can get you back on from there if your schedule permits? And I'm putting my bid in early so you can maybe carve out a little time for us to let us know what the reaction and what the position of the Progressive National Baptist Convention actually as it is articulated.
I will definitely be available to you. You just let me know what day. On that Monday, August 6th at 12 o'clock, we're going to have a march from the Marriott Hotel on Market Street to the Liberty Bell Pavilion, where we will have a press conference, and we will be speaking out against and about these issues.
How many congregants are in your convention?
Well, in total, we have about 2,500 churches across the country and in some foreign countries, and we have about 2.5 million members.
Gotcha.
However, at the convention, I'm expecting between 5,000 to 7,000 delegates.
Dr. James C. Perkins, President of the Progressive National Baptist Convention. Thank you for your work. Thank you for your time. Look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
I look forward to being with you, and thank you for this conversation today.
Thank you, sir. You've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.